Welcome to Cognitive Rampage Podcast. Hope you're taking care of you. Hope you're living your Cognitive Rampage. You have to believe in the power of you. Uncomfortable is where the change is. Comedian, turning, entrepreneur, lover of all people, ex, yep. My boy, Big Biker George, brother. How you doing, man?
I'm great, Adam. How are you?
Oh, I'm chilling, man. I'm chilling. I went off. I had this podcast that was stewing in my head for like 2 weeks.
That's not pretty.
No, it's not. And it goes and goes. I did it on healthcare. And man, I went off like 3 hours ago, something like that, 4 hours ago. I went off.
I mean, so how you feeling now? like a new man?
Yeah, I had to get it off my chest, man, and talk about it. I've done, shit, hundreds of podcasts on you know, corrupt mental health systems and stuff like that.
Mm,
and
sure.
And treatment, but you know, I hadn't talked directly about healthcare, and I went off on right wing, left wing, man.
Chicken wings.
Yeah, I'm going to lose some fans. I know that anybody's been listening and they listen to that podcast today, they're going to be like, fuck this guy.
You've lost all your healthcare professionals, probably.
Well, they'll be on. They're love. Anybody that's...
Oh, the administration and, you know, big business.
Yeah, anybody leaning heavy right, fuck me today. They're not that they're done.
I don't know how tight they were with you anyway.
Yeah. Well, you know, it was weird when I first put this podcast out, like 2015... because the logo's an elephant, they thought it was a Republican-based deal.
Yeah, because why check into it and do a little research?
Elephant, that means Republican. That's how they went into it, man. They really did, man. You know, I wanted to bring you on the show, man, and chat because, one, your history, your life, the stuff you've seen and been through, man, that's shit worth getting out, man. Some of the stories we can tell, you know what I mean?
We'll change the names to protect the guilty.
Right? Oh, man, I will, man. I mean, dude, your life is crazy, man. It's fucking insane.
It's a lot of fun. Yeah. I'll tell you that. It's quite entertaining.
Yeah, so where did Biker George come from, the name Biker George, or Big Biker?
I've hung around with various 1% motorcycle clubs in my life, and not as a member, but as more than a hang around, like a KA, a known associate. But I was more than that because I represented some of them legally. And in the biker world, you don't get to pick your own nickname. It's not how it works, you know.
Yeah,
they bestow upon you a nickname. So they used to call me Big George, and then it morphed into Big Biker George or BBG. Or I got a young comic around, Gorn, who calls me the Notorious BBG. But that's how it started, basically. I was given that nickname.
Yeah?
Yeah.
So how's the life start, man? Let's talk about your life, the whole history of it.
Which part of life?
From the beginning, man.
I started out in an orphanage. I was adopted by my folks in 1961. I do not know who my biological parents are. And I never sought them out. And it's funny because my dad's going to be 92. My mom's going to be 89. And I never sought my biological family out or my parents because I felt it would be disrespectful to them. Now,
really?
whether it truly is or not, and I wasn't worried about the medical history aspect of it, because I never had children. I didn't plan on having children, so I didn't care about that. But I felt it would be disrespectful, and that's one of the big things in my life is real or imagined disrespect really just drives me nuts.
Why would that be disrespectful to find?
I don't know if I could really put it into words. It's just a feeling that I got.
Yeah.
You know, they hand selected me out of an orphanage.
You basically, were like the pick of the litter. Is that what?
Well,
you
basically, this is how the story goes. My aunt told me this several years ago, and I'm gonna go with it. It's my truth.
All right.
So my parents go to the Catholic orphanage, and they're going on the road, and they have all the babies and the bassinets. And apparently, when my mother walked by, I threw my hands in the air, and she took that as a sign. And my dad looked at her, looked at me, and told the people, wrap this one up. We're going to take him home.
You gave the touchdown signal.
So we had that connection. So that's how everything started.
So the touchdown signal got you home.
That's it, man. That's it.
And where was home?
I grew up in Watertown, Connecticut. It's a small town outside of Waterbury, which is like between Hartford and Bridgeport, New Haven area.
Oh, I got you. How long? What was it like, man? What was the life of Big Biker George like?
I find out these things later in my life. Apparently, I was the cousin who got everybody else in trouble.
You too.
Yeah. Who knew? Who the fuck, right?
You too. You heard how I introduced myself the other day? Remember we met the city manager lady of Orlando?
At brunch?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
At brunch. Remember how I introduced myself? They said they knew my aunt, Betty Martinez. And tell her you met that cousin. I forget the word I used. I was like the bad cousin or something. I forgot what I said.
The black sheep of the family, maybe?
Yeah, tell her. I don't know what I said, but I was like, yeah, tell her you ran into that cousin or something. She's like, okay, I will. I was like, you too. All right.
So anyway, I guess I'm the one who got my cousins smoking weed and drinking and smoking cigarettes. And
I did that too, yeah.
You
all
know,
right.
All the juvenile delinquency type stuff. That's what I was doing, so, you know.
Can't help it if they're weak-minded and wanting to follow and be cool, too.
You know, not everybody can be king. Heavy is the head that wears the crown, bro, you know what I'm saying?
I do, yeah.
That crown comes with a lot of responsibility.
And pain, yeah.
You know, there's that fine line between pleasure and pain, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I do.
I started smoking weed when I was young. Then I started doing the whole drug thing. I was an A student. Up until I started partying. And then the higher I got, the lower my grades went. And it all started really, really going downhill when I had French class in eighth grade, which is weird because my father's French, you know what I mean? So, but I, you know, he didn't speak it at home because my mom wasn't French, but he'd speak it with his brothers and stuff like that.
You know French?
No, not anymore. Well, you'll understand when I finish this.
Okay,
part,
all right.
Because
I think it's funny that it all goes downhill in French class. I'm like, what the fuck happened?
Well, you know I'm one-third French.
All right.
I'm one-third French, one-third silverback gorilla, and one-third serial killer.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I don't see the French. Do you?
No, I don't. I don't see it at all.
So I'm in French class in eighth grade, and I refused to do anything. I refused to open my book. I refused to do any work in the class. So I got an F. That was my first F. I don't really know what possessed me to do that, but that was the beginning of the end for me scholastically. I went to a technical high school, and they wanted us to learn typing. And this is the mid-70s, man. Dudes didn't do typing. And listen, in the mid-70s, dudes weren't nurses, okay?
Yeah.
They certainly didn't type. And
they weren't secretaries.
No.
It's that Mad Men culture. That was the era.
That's exactly what it was. So I refused to type. So they put my desk out in the hall, which was great for me because I'd see all my buddies. You know, they get hall passes. We go outside, smoke weed. You know?
Chilling.
Yeah. You know how I would get caught doing that? I had photograph glasses. I'd come in and my glasses would be dark. It snagged every time. So I transferred from the technical school to a regular high school. And basically, because the technical school had a much more rigorous academic curriculum, when I transferred after my junior year, I had 17 and a half credits, and I think you needed 18 to graduate or something like that. I was a half a credit shy. So my thing was, I said, why don't you let me go to summer school so I can graduate? And they said, no, you're going to have to go a full year to get that credit of English.
Nowadays, they're not. They're like, okay, yeah, we'll just push it through anyway.
Nowadays, they just say, well, we'll just give you an A. I can't read. Don't worry about it. You're a scholar.
We'll push you through.
No problem. You're definitely you have political leanings. I can see it. So I told my dad, I said, listen, I want to quit school and join the Marines. My dad had a sixth grade education. He was born in 1928, so he lived through the Depression. So he had to quit school to work on the farm. So, you know, he didn't really put a lot of emphasis on education because that's not where he came from. So I quit school. I joined the Marines. I went to Paris Island, which is quite a shock.
Yeah, a little culture shock.
When you go, when you're 17 and you've really never been away from home, you go to Paris Island, that's a serious wake-up call, folks. Yeah. Believe me when I tell you.
Not quite Rikers, but close.
Rikers isn't this bad. I'm sure it's not. I'm in a few jails here and there, believe me, Marine Corps boot camp. But the problem with boot camp is 13 weeks, you know what I mean? They got you. They got you on an island, you know.
Yeah, you're done.
You know, similar to Rikers, but the problem is Rikers isn't filled with swamps that surround it that are filled with gators and snakes and spiders and every kind of creature that might possibly put some kind of poison in you. They got it or rip you apart. So I did my boot camp. I got out. I was stationed in California. I only did about 16, 18 months because there was an issue with my drug use.
Okay.
Which, I'll tell you what, when I signed up, my mom and dad had a sign for me because I was 17. But I told that recruiter, I said, hey, man, because they got a question, did you ever use drugs before? My parents knew I got high. So I said, yeah, I smoked weed, you know?
Yeah.
And the day I shipped out from the AFI station, they came up to me with a brand new page and said, well, listen, we're going to put no where it says the drug use. So, all right, what do I know? I'm 17 years old. So they changed the page, put it in my dossier.
Right, we need you in right now, so this didn't happen right now.
Yeah, don't worry about it. We need bodies, warm bodies, you know.
God.
So I get in trouble in California for drugs. And so I have what's called office hours, which is like a court-martial, but it's a step down below from a court-martial. And I get a Navy JAG lawyer. And I still remember his name, Lieutenant Brown. I said, listen, man, I told these people before I enlisted that I got high. So he goes and he pulls my records, and sure enough, all the records were dated 31 August 1978, except for the one page where they changed it, and they put the date I shipped out, 7 September 78.
Oops.
So I ended up getting an honorable general under honorable condition discharge.
Nice.
You know, so I was out of there. And this is what the lawyer said, Lieutenant Brown. He goes, hey, man, just hang on the beach until your discharge comes in. Because I was in San Diego. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I was living large.
Yeah,
so,
San Diego in the late 70s.
Oh, it was happening, bro.
Oh, I bet.
It was happening.
Shit.
I had a lot of fun in San Diego. Get my discharge in January of 1980. I take the bus back because I got, listen, I'm a drug guy, so I got just enough money and drugs to make it home. Hopefully.
Back then, you're adding shit up. Yeah, yeah, I remember that. Like, all right, I got to go an hour.
Okay, we're going to stop in St. Louis. I could have a grilled cheese and a tomato soup, cup of tomato soup.
Yeah.
And three beers.
So here's our way to bread right now.
We're smoking dope the whole way in the back of the bus. So when we change buses in St. Louis, we start heading out. The driver goes, just want to let you hippies and freaks know you're not in California anymore, so put that weed out. Okay, pops. So I come back. How real you want me to get with everything?
Brother, please. Be as real as fuck, man.
All right. So what happened was I had some mental health issues that were undiagnosed and untreated. Okay. And looking back on my life, I can see periods of time. Listen, my life was either I felt like killing myself or I wanted to kill the whole world. I either want to conquer or just, you know, wash away. You know, there was no in between. But I didn't understand that when I was that young, what was going on. So I did a lot of self-medicating to try to keep myself right in the middle, you know. So I ended up trying to commit suicide in 1980, about 4 or 5 months after I got back from California. I ended up shooting myself, but I didn't hit any vital organs.
Fuck.
Yeah. So.
Fuck, man. I know you this long. I didn't even know this stuff, man.
Well, you wanted it real.
Yeah, baby. Please. So,
but I also have to tell you that, you know, when I was 9 years old, I took about 40 or 50 aspirin. See, all this started way back when, you know. And I'm sure if you did some analysis on me, well, we don't have that much time, but
I already am right now. I can't help. So, tell me how that makes you feel, man.
makes me feel good. Good to be honest.
I'm going to need some wine. Keep going.
No problem. Patricia? So, I got out of hospital after that. And this is the funniest part about that. I was promoting a big, big keg party band gig. Huge. We had like 300 people coming. Sold advance tickets. I think we bought 30 kegs, whatever it was. This party was going to happen like the day after I got out of the hospital. So all my relatives and my aunts and my mom and everybody are trying to talk me out of them. I'm like, so I'm appeasing them. You know, I'm telling them, yeah, but in the back of my mind goes, this party's on.
Yeah.
So I get out.
They're right after shooting yourself. You're walking right into another party.
Oh, yeah.
All right. Yeah.
That's addiction at its finest, bro.
Yeah, man.
So we have the party. It's a huge success. You know what I mean? 300-400 kids, you know what I mean? And, you know, and I was the guy that had to talk to the police when they came. You know, there's always that one guy that's got to talk to the police.
Designated talker, yeah, not the driver.
No, not the driver, the talker. You know what I mean? Because I don't know how it is now, because, you know, I've been sober and clean and sober and clean for almost 9 years. So back then, ultimately, the police were going to show up to your parties. Whether you're out in the woods or at somebody's house, it's not a matter of if, it's when. So I would talk to the police when they came. We had that great party. And I just continued to self-medicate, and I got in a rock band. I was the lead singer, and we played a lot of gigs. And it's funny because we played at a place called the Main Street Supper Club in Oakville, Connecticut. And every time we played there, they sold out of beer. I think that was just from the band, but I don't know.
That's the achievements right there, man. We sold out beer. Now, I don't know about tickets, but we sold out of beer.
We weren't even doing it for money at that point. We were doing it just for the free
drinks. What was the name of the band?
It was called Stonehouse Thor.
Okay. Yeah. What were you playing, metal?
We're doing hard rock.
Okay, yeah.
Alice Cooper, Deep Purple, ZZ Top, Cream, that kind of stuff.
Hell yeah.
So I got voted out of the band.
What?
Because I didn't have the look. Because you got to remember, right now I'm 300 plus pounds, long hair, beard. Hey, everybody. but back then, I was 200 pounds. And, you know, I just.
What look did they want?
They wanted the look of this Italian dude who looked like John Travolta with the blowback hair. Yeah. And this was the weirdest part about that. I don't know if our repertoire was 40 or 50 songs, but I knew all the songs. I knew all the lyrics. Not a problem. So they get this dude, Vinny, and he can't remember one lyric.
Oops.
He has to have the lyrics up on a music stand for every song.
Oh, hell no. You can't do karaoke when you're playing hard.
See, that was the demise. That was the beginning of the demise of the band. So nobody wants to see that stuff.
That's karaoke right in front of people, man.
Yeah.
You can't do that shit.
That was karaoke before people were doing karaoke. You know, it might be cool now, but it wasn't cool then.
Yeah.
So the band kind of imploded at that point, and those guys got into some other things. I did some theater after that.
That's a jump.
I played Jack Ruby in an original play by Harold Pantley in Oakville, Connecticut. I played Jack Ruby. And we had a lot of fun with that. It was called the 3 Days of November about the Kennedy assassination.
Yeah.
And that was great. And I started getting into some stuff like that. It was around that time, the late 80s, where I got clean.
What was it, the music? I mean, what started making you want to turn your life around to get clean like that?
I'm not really sure if it was the music per se, but I knew that when I drank a lot, I'd get busted. Mm. And it was funny because if it was always the alcohol that was the tipping point.
Yeah.
Anytime I had any trouble with law enforcement, was always the alcohol. Alcohol induced.
Yeah, that's the killer, man.
You know?
Excuse me, I have to drink some wine right now, but yeah. No, but you're right, it is.
New Year's Eve, 1982, I'm at a house party in Waterbury, Connecticut. And
nice.
I had this collector Jack Daniels bottle. It was a crystal decanter.
I'm looking real bad right now. I'm double fisting wine glasses, man.
I'm not, this is a judgment free zone. Fucking better saying, be, man.
Fucking Planet Fitness right now, man. What the fuck?
Your liver's like, yeah.
Yeah, my brain's like,
Adam's back.
Yeah, my inside's like, what the fuck, man? It's,
man,
Tuesday.
Does this guy ever eat?
Was it Tuesday?
I don't know. Well, I get technically, yeah, those are grapes, I guess.
Yeah. Jesus did it. You know what I mean? What would Jesus do? He drank that shit. That's what he'd do.
He'd turn this into some wine. So, New Year's Eve, 1982. We go to a house party, and I don't know if they did it jokingly or what, but they stole my decanter. I was like, just give me the, and this is a $50 decanter. And this story is funny because, well, I don't know if it's funny or not, but so I go to my apartment and I get my sawed-off shotgun.
the equal response to stealing a canter.
Because everything I did, everything was larger than life. Who in their right mind goes and gets a sawed-off shotgun to retrieve a $50 piece of glass? Apparently, I do.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
But
yeah.
Not my right mind. So I go back to the party, and I got the gun behind my back, and then I walk in, and I present it to everybody like I'm holding a baby, you know?
Jesus.
30, 40 kids in the house. Scatter like roaches when you turn on the light. You never saw 40 people move so quickly in so many different directions in your life. So, of course, they call the police. I go upstairs because I tried to get out, but I couldn't get out because the cops were coming in. So I go upstairs, and I'm hiding, but they catch me because I'm hiding in a bed. That's how lit I am.
Yeah, it doesn't work. Yeah.
I won't get out of bed. I'm not gonna fight them, but I'm not gonna make myself easily accessible.
Yeah.
So they mace me and they drag me outside.
Oh.
So I'm standing there cuffed, maced. But what I did was I closed both of my eyes really tightly, so I could still see a little bit out of one of my eyes. So I'm standing there, and these two fairly young cops, they go, "Hey, let's give them a New Year's Eve gift and beat the shit out of them." So I looked at these guys. I go, "I'll tell you what, man. You do whatever you got to do. But I got your badge numbers. I'm not going to rat you out. But I am going to come and get you."
Damn.
They didn't lay a finger on me.
Because
I would have.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Listen, you want to take off your jewelry and your gun and your badge and you want to throw down? That's fine. Even two of you. Whatever. Yeah. You know? But when you're going to try to tune somebody up when they're in handcuffs, come on. Yeah. Come on. That's a punk move.
Yeah.
So that was 1982. Went to a ton of concerts, man. I was big into the concerts. Loved them all. Saw The Who in New York.
Damn.
Shea Stadium.
Classic, man. Townsend.
It was their first farewell tour.
Yeah, how many?
38 years ago.
Right, was the last one last month, I think.
Oh, they're still touring, man.
Yes, I mean, right. 28 years ago were your first farewell.
It was a crazy show. We had David Johansen from the New York Dolls. He did a set with his band, but he did all Animals tunes.
Yeah.
And then The Clash opened up for The Who. And then
yeah, I was playing out that before we got live. I was playing The Clash, man.
Yeah. So that was
I didn't play the
show.
Other one. Daddy was a bank robber. I didn't play that one. I played
play whatever you want, man. That's the beauty of having your own show. So I started doing concerts, and you know, and I went to work for my father. My father was working at a thread factory, And it was funny because in the town where we lived, almost everybody at some point in their life worked in this factory. So they called it the college.
Get your degree.
Come on to the college. So I don't know if anybody else out there has ever worked for family, but it can be very, very difficult.
That's saying it nice. Fuck working with family.
You're better off working with strangers because then you can tell them to fuck off and you don't have to see them at breakfast the next morning.
Yeah, you don't feel bad, man. I'm just pulling up the sound, man. Go ahead.
Keep going. All good. So I worked there for a while. And then I got married first time in 1988. And I decided I want to go back to school.
1988. How old were you?
27. You know, I've been out of school for 10 years. 10, 11 years, whatever. I didn't know if I could...
I feel like we're skipping a lot of really good stories and all this shit.
What are you looking for?
I'm not looking for anything. I just feel like we just skipped over. We went to one party, a few concerts, one arrest. And I feel like we...
All right, so I have a 64 Ford Falcon.
Uh-huh.
So we pile four bikers and a chick into it. We're going to go from Connecticut to a suburb of Boston, Somerville, Mass.
So you were all in the biker realm during all this?
Yeah, I was still, yeah.
Okay.
For sure. So we pile in the Falcon convertible, and we drive up to Somerville. And we go up there, and we go to a place called the Golden Banana. It's a strip club in Boston. We didn't know it, but it was mob run.
Oops.
So we... But we were in there spending money, having a blast. It was
that's fine, but mob and bikers got a hell of a history together.
We were polite. We were having a great time. We treated the ladies with respect. In fact, they gave us a 6-pack to go when we left, so we knew everything. You know,
nice.
But I had a little suspension problem with the Falcon, and we went over the railroad tracks, and we had so many people in the car, bottomed out, put a hole in the gas tank.
Oh, shit.
So I call my cousin. So he comes out and he's got some tank fees. He's got some whatever that putty shit is. He puts a couple pennies in there and putties over them. We stay. Oh, we get there at midnight and my aunt Irene, little Irene, because there was two Irenes. There was big Irene and little Irene. She cooks us a complete roast beef dinner at midnight.
Hell yeah.
Smashed potatoes, gravy.
Yeah.
Veggies, Belchables. Oh, yeah. And my Uncle Morris, who was a World War II vet, lost his leg in World War II. And this is how cool he was. He bought a house for his brother-in-law's sister and said, just pay me the rent every month, whatever the mortgage was. Back then, I don't know, $150, but whatever. When they finished paying that, he gave them the deed to the house.
Shit.
Yeah, he was a righteous dude.
Yeah, man.
They also had a cat that they got. They found this cat when it was about 4 months old. It was an attack cat. It sat on the windowsill, and they had it on a leash.
What?
Because if you got close to it, it would try to scratch your eyes out.
Oh, I like this cat.
I'm
not a cat guy, but I like this cat already.
This cat is cool, right? My aunt had this cat for about 15 years. She used to push the food over to it with a stick.
No shit. Jesus.
So we go to the Golden Banana and we get fucked up, okay? We come home, wake up in the morning, smell the bacon cooking and shit. She's made homemade bread. We got bacon, eggs, home fries, fresh coffee. So I got this one guy, Billy, and I said, stay away from the cat. He goes, animals love me. I go, you don't understand, man. This cat does not enjoy human interaction. He goes, animals love me. So he puts his chair fairly close to the cat, turns his back, and winds up with about an 18-inch scratch. Went right through his shirt, man. He's bleeding through his shirt.
Like he got in a knife fight.
And my aunt, you know, she's salt in the earth. She goes, hey, Billy, I told you not to sit near the cat. So we come home, and we got the girl in the car with us, and she decides she wants to flash, which is wonderful.
Yeah, I mean, nobody's there.
She's well endowed, and she's flashing to various people on the highway. And a tractor trailer pulls right next to us. And the dude, you know, the dude's cool. I think we threw him a beer or something, whatever. So this long-haired young lady sticks her head out the window, and she's got this really impressive beaded, braided headband on. And she's got one of those suede tops with the fringe.
Yeah. She's going full hippie.
And I'm driving, and I'm fixated on that headband, you know, that thing she's wearing. Well, I didn't realize it, but she had flashed us like 3 or 4 times.
And you're on a headband.
And I'm stuck on a headband, and they're like, what's the matter with you, man? I don't know, everything, you know? So they split. So now I look in the rear view. Literally, as far as you can see, there are tractor trailers in the left-hand lane trying to get up to us because, you know, those guys. Hey, there's a chick in a convertible flashing your titties.
Yeah, this is Red Rover. Come on up. You got the hole on the left side.
Is it Red Rover? Throw me a boner. So anyway, we let some of them catch up, and she flashes them and shit, you know. That was a lot of fun. Around that time, there was a motorcycle club in Waterbury, Connecticut, and they were going to start a brand new chapter, and because it was going to be a brand new chapter, we weren't going to have to probate or be prospects. Probating is when you're a probationary member. There's a certain time period. Most of the larger clubs, it's up to a year. Some are more than that. Most of them no less than 6 months, where you're in this probationary position, prospective member, where you have to do whatever these guys tell you to do, okay? Like an initiation. So this one gentleman, he was going to be the president. I was invited to join them. But at the time, I had a choice to make. It was either going to be my first wife or the club.
Mm.
And that was the ultimatum. So I decided to join the club. So I said to the guy who was going to be president, I said, listen, man, you're going to have to put me up for a little while because I'll be out in the streets. You know, because if I'm going to be aligning with you guys, I got no place to stay. This dude told me, he said, my wife won't let you stay with us.
What the fuck?
I go, how are you going to run a club when your wife is running your household?
Yeah, you're right.
So that was the end of that right there for me with those guys. You know what I mean? I was like, fuck these guys.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? You gotta be shitting me, right? So that's the mid-80s. Let's see. I go to my first motorcycle rally in the mid-80s. It's the Harley Rendezvous up in New York State. And we have a great time. I'm watching the bands, and there's this dude standing next to me. He goes, you want some mushrooms? I'm like, hell yeah, I do, buddy. So he gives me the bag. I take a few buttons. Fucking, these things are tremendous.
I'm seeing all of it right now.
I'm seeing colors.
Yeah.
You know, I'm tasting sounds. As it turned out, he was one of the headliners at the show. His name was Biker Joe Warren. I don't know if he's still alive, but he put a hell of a show on. Cool guy. So I go back to the campsite, and everybody at the campsite is drunk as shit, wasted. So I'm going to go for a beer run because everybody else is so drunk they can't, you know. So I get on my bike, and I get about 4 campsites up, and I'm tripping my brains out.
Yeah.
So I say to the dude at the campsite, I go, hey, man, is there if I leave my bike here? He goes, shit, yeah, don't worry about it, brother. So I walk back to the campsite. I said, hey, man, I need some help getting my bike back. Okay. So our buddy Joe Walsh, not the singer.
Yeah, I was going to say,
his real name was Mike, but we called him Joe.
I was going to say, shit.
And right. I just saw Joe about 3-4 years ago. I hadn't seen him in almost 30 years. Still cool. Still cool. We saw him. I took him to a Kid Rock show up in Tampa. So anyway, Joe and I walk back to the campsite where the bike is. Thanks, bro. Good luck, fellas. So, I say, listen, I just want you to steer. Just get on the bike and steer. I'm going to push you. So, I push the bike back, and the whole way there, Joe's going, room, room. So, when they finally come down a little bit, we make our run, we get our supplies. And I come back, and it had been raining. So the field you know, there's dirt roads and a few little paved like walkways and shit, but it's dirt roads. So I make a left through the field to cut over to our campsite, and I get about 40 feet, and I just sink down and lay over on the side. The bike goes right over, right? I turn and look. There's like 20 guys behind me. They were following me. They must have thought I knew where I was going, you know? So that was my first rally. We really had a great time. But that's when I really started doing the biker thing. And I stopped it when I went to Vermont. Well, okay, so from there...
For a lot of people, they know the biker life from what they see, right? Movies, etc., right? TV shows, all that kind of shit. I mean, they romanticize it, let's be honest. You know what I mean? Like Sons of Anarchy, right, made this shit real big. Documentaries that talk about it. Can you talk about what that life's really like, man? Like, what living that life and choosing to be on that side, whether trying to be a 1% or join 1% type gangs, or being on that side, man? What's that?
Motorcycle clubs.
Motorcycle clubs, sorry. Yeah, you're right. What's that life really like for those that romanticize the shit?
It's male-dominated, sexist, pretty much racist, homophobic society.
Mm.
For the most part, from what I saw. Yeah. You know what I mean? Women are basically property. The women in the club who are actually with one of the club members almost always exclusively wear something that says property of fill in the blank, Road Dog, you know, Scooter, or whatever. Women are considered property. It's a lot of drug use. A lot of drug use. It can get very violent at times. Think of the Wild West on motorcycles.
Mm, yeah.
You know, lawless society in the 1800s. You know, a lot of the guys didn't work. They didn't hold regular jobs. Some of them had trades. A lot of money was made from prostitution of the women. Not necessarily the old ladies, you know, the property ladies, but other women who would hang around, club mamas they're called, which are basically women who make themselves sexually available to anyone in the club for the opportunity to hang around. Stripping, exotic dancing, that kind of stuff. Of course, drug sales, guns. It's a lot like what was portrayed in the Sons of Anarchy, but some of that stuff, I knew a 1%er around here. He used to call it the Sons of Malarkey.
It's not how it really goes down.
Well, it's Hollywood. You know what I mean? What in Hollywood is reality, really?
Yeah.
The reality shows in Hollywood are not real.
Yeah.
I shot a sizzle reel for a reality show. You know how many times I had a... shoot me riding into the office on my motorcycle 8 times.
Because it's not reality, yeah.
No. But that's, you know, most of the guys weren't very educated. And one of the things I didn't like, the guys that were really, really tight with their other brothers were... righteous, but there was a lot of other stuff going on under the surface that I wasn't a big fan of. You know what I mean? My life motto is love, respect, honor, and loyalty. Okay, and I don't ask anybody in my life to live up to anything that I don't live.
Yeah.
So because of that, my circle is small and getting smaller as I age. Because if I tell you that I love you till I die. I'm there for you. I don't tell you fuck off when shit gets deep, shit gets hard. You know?
Yeah.
That's when we close our ranks and we circle the wagons, man, and we take care of each other, you know? So there was some stuff going on that I really didn't like. I represented a bunch of 1%ers. Then they didn't want to pay their bills, you know? Hey, listen, you know, nobody works for free.
Yeah.
Nobody. And listen, I don't expect anybody to. I don't mind helping somebody out. You know, but if you owe me money and I see you in the bar blowing $200-$300 and you owe me money, that's fucked up.
Yeah, we got a problem. You know? I mean, you came up, really, that whole era was sort of like the peak, if not sort of, was the peak of that biker generation, man. You had the Hells Angels, Warlocks. I mean, you started, those major names were fucking well known in the 80s. Mm-hmm. That cocaine era that was coming through, the crack era that was coming through. I mean, that's really where...
And the crank, the meth.
Yeah.
That's a choice drug for a lot of bikers. Mm. Because you could party and you could ride your bike for a fucking weekend and not sleep and party. You
yeah,
know what I mean?
Yeah.
And just keep you wired. You
yeah, know? That was the... I mean, that was the era, man. Like, all these Sons of Anarchy, all this shit is really... They're trying to do a new time, but it was based in that 70s, 80s era.
That the 60s, 70s, and 80s, I think, was the golden era for 1% outlaw clubs.
Yeah.
You know, because now, with the government... The government took the patch from the Mongols,
yeah,
because they said they were a criminal organization. But I don't know if it was the U.S. Supreme Court, but they got their patch back because yeah. what they said was that just because there are some criminal element, some people are criminals in an organization, does not mean that the whole organization is criminal.
Yeah, and you know, I know a bunch of Mongols. Great dudes. They do some amazing stuff. You know? They do some amazing stuff in their community.
Well, you know what they say, the bad we do, they never remember. The bad we do, they never forget. The good we do, they never remember.
Yeah. Yeah, I've seen them pull together small towns and things like that and bring them back and do things for businesses in towns, man. I mean, sure, they do some other things too. Right?
Can't begrudge a man for turning a dollar.
Right, I wouldn't do that, you know, but I didn't know that.
This is a judgment-free zone,
that's
folks.
It, baby, that's it, man. But I didn't know they actually lost their patch and got it back.
Yeah, yeah. I also, for those of you who don't know, I'm also an attorney, criminal defense attorney. I represented a local one percenter two counts of attempted murder and three counts of aggravated battery with a deadly weapon with intent to kill. And the funny part was that he was innocent. And I have people who are listening or watching or whatever go, yeah, right. But he really was. He was attacked by a couple of guys downtown Orlando and defended himself. A couple of martial artists attacked him, had him in a rear naked chokehold. He ended up pulling his knife and defending himself. And the guys got cut in the process. So we went to trial. Well, what happened was the assistant state attorney offered 5 years of prison followed by 10 years of probation. And, you know, as we got closer and closer to trial, my client started to get nervous. He's like, ah, man, I want to go to prison. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
He was a fairly young guy, late 20s. And I told him, I said, listen, man, you got to have faith here. I said, his case is weak because... he's only offering a 5-year sentence.
Yeah, with 10 years probation, right?
Right,
yeah.
Right.
If it's flipped, if you got 10 years inside, 5 years probation.
Or in a case like that, you would expect a 20-year offer. Mm. Because you can get life for the attempted murders, right?
Yeah.
So he was almost going to take it, and I talked to him, and he said, fuck it, let's go to trial. We picked a jury on my birthday, 2008, and... we started the trial on my wife's birthday, my second wife's birthday, on August 5th. And we I don't know if we went 2 or 3 days. The judge dismissed both of the attempted murder charges because there was no intent on that.
Yeah, then I mean, he was attacked.
Right, but, you know, when you're talking about a biker, listen, this is what the media in Hollywood has done for the biking community. All the bikers are robbers and killers and rapists and drug dealers and you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So they already have a preconceived notion from the media and from Hollywood of what these people are.
And he's stepping in as a 1%er with the resume, I imagine.
He had facial tattoos, okay? And there was a woman, a potential juror, who said she could not be on the jury because she was from Central America. And in her country, in Central America, people with facial tattoos were killers.
Yeah, I'm going to guess Honduras or Guatemala.
Right in that area.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's what she said straight up. So, as it turned out, he's found out guilty of the aggravated batteries with serious bodily injury. And it was funny because I saw him some time after that, and he had tattooed on his side, his right side, a knife, and it had the arrest date on top, and it had his not guilty date on the bottom.
Shit. Man, sometimes they get too far with the tattoos. You're telling on yourself.
Well, he...
But it's not guilty, so he's good. He's
not guilty, man. And double jeopardy attaches.
So really, if that's anybody else, we're talking stand your ground.
It didn't have stand your ground. Well, stand your big. Ground wasn't big then.
Yeah.
You know?
I'm just meaning his reputation or the biker that he is or, you know...
The reputation precedes you when in a situation like that.
Yeah.
He wasn't even downtown wearing his colors or anything. He's just downtown at a club.
Yeah.
And we find out after the fact that the two guys that were involved were trying to get a lawsuit against the bar.
Oh, shit.
So they had some devious motives anyway. Their motives were suspect to begin with.
Yeah, yeah.
So he got acquitted, didn't have to go to jail or prison. You know.
You get favors.
Well, no, you know, I do my thing, man. But see, this is how it works. I have a lot of success as an attorney.
Yeah.
But that's my higher power working through me to help others when they can't help themselves. Yeah. I can't take all the credit. I don't take the credit for this stuff.
Yeah.
You know? I've had some people tell me that I'm their angel, that I'm some kind of a guardian angel. I've had 3 or 4 people tell me that in the last 6 months.
I'm glad you're here. I need one of those.
I'm starting to believe it.
I need one of those right now, man.
whatever you need, bro.
I don't know if it's an attorney or guardian angel, but I'm going to need one soon, man.
You're way too pretty for prison. Way too pretty.
Yeah, I get that. So look, take me back, man. So, you know, you're coming through the 80s, right? You've been in and out of a biker life, man, and partying life, addiction.
Oh, let me tell you when
I
was about, I don't know, man, 11 or 12. And they used to, some grocery store I went with my parents, but there was a motorcycle magazine. And so I bought it, unbeknownst to my parents. We got some other stuff to talk about too, man. So I get the biker magazine, and I'm reading this one article. And these guys are partying to celebrate the life of one of their brothers who died.
Yeah.
And I thought about, see, I was raised more Roman Catholic, and that whole death thing is a drag, okay?
Your death sucks.
Yeah. And then you die.
Yeah, death sucks.
Life sucks, then
you
die.
I'm with you on that one, man. Yeah, that whole death thing, it's fucked up.
So I was really attracted to the fact that these guys were riding the motorcycles and celebrating somebody's life who had died. You know what I mean? Yeah. I was just drawn to it. And there was a lot of bikers in my, you know, when I was growing up, you know what I mean? There was motorcycle clubs around, you know. There's some guys in Meriden, some guys in Waterbury. So, you know, I gravitated towards that lifestyle, you know.
Yeah.
I remember the first time my dad saw me, and he drove by, saw me at a biker bar. And I saw him at home later, and he goes, "That's a rough crowd." Yeah, they are, Dad. That's just the women.
Yeah. Seriously, man. I had some run-ins in my day of the things I did, man. And, you know, there were I'm going to leave the stories out, but in these two moments, you know, I've been in some choice situations.
Tight spots.
Yeah. Yeah. And two out of the three stories of my life, where I was the most terrified, where I was the most inside. Now, you couldn't tell on the outside. Inside, I'm like, I don't think I'm getting out of this one. I think this is it.
Cool on the outside. Because nobody could tell what you're feeling.
Yeah. No, on the inside, I'm like, oh, fuck. This is it.
You're picking out headstones.
Yeah. I'm like, this is it. This is it. But two out of those three stories involved being at a biker bar / party clubhouse. It was all the same thing. And working a little something there. And hoping to God I got out of there alive. And those some were friends. You know, it's so quick. I've never seen a place where I've been where friends turn on you so quickly.
The dynamic can change instantly.
Fuck, man.
Because you are an outsider.
Yeah.
Those guys, no matter what goes down, at the end of the day, that's still his brother. So he's going to defend what that guy is doing. Yeah. Whether it's stealing from you, fucking your old lady, beating the shit out of you, they're going to converge together and stomp you like a grape.
Yeah.
Okay?
Yeah, I was in there with three dudes and the other two boys, I should say. And the one bugged out. He was getting too scared and just left.
Because that's what you really want in a friend, is somebody's going to run as soon as the shit gets a little thick.
And nothing had to act. You just felt the energy. Nobody said nothing. It was, and he was just like, and he just left.
It's worse when nothing is said.
And I'm talking, this is Orlando area, right, Central Florida area, and he bugged out, you know, and I felt that energy.
He wasn't cut out for that lifestyle, apparently.
No. But I looked around for a minute, I was like, oh, no. I'm like, well, this. When you know that you've been there, I'm sure, a couple times and moments in your life, well, this
I'm
is
right
it.
There right now.
You're like, well, this is it. This is it, man.
This is how I go. This is how I check out.
This is it, man. And it turned quickly one way, then quickly the other way, and everything was fine. You know, and we left, everything was cool. But another choice time of that. But out of the three times in my life I've been most scared, those two involved a biker community. And where I was terrified for my fucking life. And it ended up great afterwards. Like, okay, whoo. But fuck, that ride home, you're like, holy shit.
I'm going to be talking about this someday on a podcast.
That I wasn't thinking. That I was thinking, I ain't saying shit ever to anybody.
I ain't going
to
tell anybody I shit my shorts a little bit.
It was a little bit where you're like, fuck.
Man, I'm glad I had skivvies on, man.
Man, I'm telling you. But yeah, that lifestyle, man, and only being a part of it, a few things in and out, you know, with some choice people. Fuck, one of the roughest lifestyles I ever saw.
You also have to be ready to donate a portion of your life to incarceration.
Yeah.
Sometimes you got to take one for the club.
Yeah.
You know, somebody gets busted, but you know, or whatever. And it's not as easy to get out of a club as some people might think.
Sure. You know sure. What I mean? Just like a lot of other gangs
organizations.
Yeah. Organizations for you sure. Know, yeah.
When you get in, it's possibly for life, you know what I mean?
If you're an earner for that organization,
you're not going anywhere.
Yeah, exactly.
You're locked in, baby.
You're not walking. You're not walking.
We can let some of the muscle go, but we're not letting the money roll. Yeah. Never.
No, you don't get to walk out.
That's for sure.
So what starts to turn you, man? I think I cut you off. You were deciding to go back to school or do something. What was there a moment or a night or something that happened where you said, you know, I have that moment, right, for me.
I talked about it earlier, to tell you the truth.
Yeah.
When I was going to be part of that new chapter.
Yeah.
Okay. But the guy who was going to run the chapter, I couldn't stay at his house for a while till I got on my feet. You know, that kind of soured me about the whole thing. I was like, what the fuck kind of shit is this?
Yeah.
So at that point, I was still riding, doing my own thing. But I was working construction at the time for the laborers union. And I've been doing it for a while. And this is how they trap you in construction. The money's good, man. Right out of the box, you're making big money.
Yeah.
Okay.
Especially union work.
Union work. And now, this is up north. This is in New England where the unions are still strong.
Especially in the 80s. Jesus.
Oh, well, they were powerful.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
They still had all their cojones. And so you get trapped by the big money. And what happens is people get married, they start buying houses, they start having kids who need braces and who got to go to college and this and that.
Health care, you know, the whole thing.
So at this point, you know, you've been doing it 10, 15, 20 fucking years, you're 45, what are you going to do, you know? I was working on the Charter Oak Bridge in Hartford, Connecticut, and I was working with some iron workers, some steel workers. And we're sitting around having lunch, and this dude goes, "Hey, man, you know, I've been listening to you. You're a smart kid. You got a head on your shoulders." He says, "Do yourself a favor. Get the fuck out now." He says, "You're going to get trapped by the money," because he described to me what I just said about you, by the house. You get the wife, the car, the kids, you know, the mortgage, all that shit. He says, "I'm 55 years old. I've been doing this for 40 years. Okay? I've fallen off bridges. I've been hit by beams." And he went through a long laundry list of things that had happened to him, how he'd been injured over the years on, you know, just, you know, working.
Yeah.
You know, it's a dangerous, you know, construction is dangerous.
Oh, yeah.
He said, "I'm 55. I look like I'm 75. I feel like I'm 105. He said, "Get the fuck out now before you get trapped." So I thought about it. You know, I went home and I said to my wife, hey, you know, I'm thinking about going back to school. She goes, well, it sounds like a good idea. You know, why don't you?
Oh, it sounds good.
Oh, everything sounds good, especially upstairs, you know what I mean, in the head.
He's selling yourself on that shit.
You got him, man. Yeah. Who else is going to buy that bullshit, right? So because of my drug use, I didn't know how if I had burned myself out, you know, mentally. So what I did was I took a couple of classes. I took a beginner Spanish class, and I took a sign language class at a local community college. But they weren't like college classes. They were just like, you know.
See if you're too fucked up.
Yeah. So I did really, really well with those. So.
¿Habla español?
Pico.
Okay.
Pico de gallo.
I got sign language? I'm good. I'm not. I don't know. Yeah, yeah. You know that? Oh, shit. Yeah, I'm not putting that one up.
You know what it is?
I'm not putting that one up.
You know
up.
What it is, though?
Not nowadays, it changed.
No, this one here in the sign language community means asshole.
Ah, all right. You know that's a thing now with the white supremacy.
Oh, I did not know.
Well, actually, it's not tight. It's the OK symbol. That given OK has now been linked directly to white supremacy. It's ridiculous. Now, I learned to throw gang signs pretty good in my day. You know, so I used to be able to cross them up.
I got arthritis now. I could barely give a peace sign.
I figured I'd be good for sign language. I could throw them up from a distance. You know what I mean? And
you probably want to throw them from a distance.
Yeah, most do.
You're not
do.
As young as you once were.
Most do. Most do.
And I see you're not wearing red or blue, so.
No. We were white ragging, but yeah. Never mind. I'm stopped. Let me stop. Let me stop. You were okay. Saying.
Where were we?
Spanish and sign language.
So I take these classes and I do well. So I enroll in community college, and I'm really enjoying it. And I take a problems. No, I'm taking psychology. I'm going to. First is general studies, and then when I go for a bachelor's or whatever. So I'm taking a bunch of psychology courses.
That's where you get fucked up right there, man.
Oh, yeah. Anybody who's fucked up, they usually major in psychology.
Yeah. You know? Four different times. And salute. Cheers to that. Salute to being
and
fucked up.
And he's using every one of them, people. Money and energy well spent.
Shit, waste of fucking time. If I could take it back, I would. If I could go back and unlearn all of that psychology shit, man, there's days I'm not, but there's days I'm like, take it out of my head.
Come on. Listen, everything you've done in your whole life has led you right here, right now, to this moment.
I was making bad choices, apparently.
Well, if something works for you, you stick with it.
Yeah. Psych classes earlier.
So I got one of my psych classes. We get a test back, and there's three blonde cheerleaders in front of me. And I get my paper, and I look at their papers, and there's a D minus, and an F. And they look at my paper, and it's an A.
Oh, shit.
They look at my paper, they look at me. They look at each other's papers, they look at me. I look at them, I go, don't look like an A student, do I?
They're like, who did you pay? Who did you fucking pay
to get who did this? You intimidate?
Yeah, who did you threaten to get this paper done?
Who do you have a little something on?
But I think there's something to that, man. I think people that...
Well, I was a non-traditional student also. You got to remember, I was 28 years old, 27 years old.
You're ahead.
Yeah. With a bunch of life experiences.
But I think there's something about that person, man, that has the life experience. Because, look, man, I was not a good student through school, man. I made enough to go play college football. That was the whole fucking goal, right?
How'd that work out for you?
I played 2 years, and then that was it for me. But beyond that, well, I played some semi-pro after that, and that was just stupid. Other than that, you know, I wasn't some genius guy, man, at all. And, you know, I was a B student at best, you know. And when I decided after a federal arrest, after a whole line, and I'm going, I got to do something different with this shit.
You got to try something different because that shit wasn't working, man.
That was just my, I only been arrested twice. You know, the first is just a little jitterbug trying to do shit. And then the second was like, oh, what the fuck? You know, and then I left all that. You know, the whole book tells you about the walkabout. But I came back, and when I started psychology, dude, I made one B. The rest were A's. Like, never in my life.
That fucked you out of your 4.0.
That was pissed.
Me, I had a teacher that did that to me. I had an instructor. She gave me a fucking B+, so I couldn't have a 4.0.
Dude, me and that teacher had an issue. I almost went back to that old guy. And I'm like, then I realized I'm arguing this bitch over a B right now.
But that's not what normal people do.
No, they don't. They're like,
they're happy to get the B and they move on.
I was pissed. But, I mean, what is it, you think, man, about those that have, like, because my book smarts weren't there, you know what I mean? Now, at the time, I'd read 4,000 books. I was a reading addict at the time. I'm not anymore. But I was. But what do you think is it about those that, like, have the street experience, the life experience, that all of a sudden, you know, nobody was telling you or me that, like, you're a scholar. You know what I mean?
Oh, definitely not. But I'll tell you what, man. I always had an affinity for books, and I would just devour them voraciously. When I was about 10 or 11, I went to the store, and I bought The Rise and Fall of the Third Reich, The Godfather, and Serpico. And I was reading all three of them. And then my mom found them and confiscated them. I think he never gave them back to me.
Yeah, you know? That's okay.
But I had a voracious appetite to learn, man. I don't know what it was. But see, the drugs, they dulled all that. Because, listen, all they want to do is party, you know?
Yeah.
Because I used to talk to my wife now about wasted potential in all these years.
Shout out, Susan.
Yeah. What's up, baby? I didn't know if I was going to go to med school or law school.
Damn.
And, I had been looking at some schools where I was going to be able to tailor my curriculum exactly the way I wanted to. I was going to be a pediatrician if I was going to be
looking out for the little ones. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I've always been a champion for the downtrodden and the underdog, you know, and I love kids, even though I never had kids, you know, dogs and kids love me, so I can't be all bad. You know what I'm saying? So, I thought about it, med school, you know, residency, all this, 10 plus years, law school, 3 years. I could still help people. So I went with the law aspect of it. So I get my 2-year degree in Connecticut, and I moved to Vermont because I want to be a dairy farmer. Because, you know, yeah, man.
What the fuck?
There's no segues. My life is like my comedy. I don't have segues per se.
Yeah, what the fuck,
we
man?
Go from this to that, you know what
biker,
I mean?
Biker, hanging out large, playing in bands, partying until it's home, hanging with 1%ers, crossing over to maybe med school, pediatrician, I don't know. But for now, I'm going to be a dairy farmer.
So I get a job in Connecticut for 3 months milking cows so I can go to Vermont and get a job. But I'm also going to go to school. Well, I had some thought about going to school up there. So I go, I get a job on a dairy farm milking cows up in Vermont. I wait the 1 year for the state residency so I can go to school at state cost instead of out of state cost, which is, there's a big difference. I don't know how it is down here, but.
Yeah, no, out of state and state, yeah, that's a motherfucker, yeah.
So it was worth the 1 year.
That's the second mortgage difference.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah. Braces or no braces. Your teeth are straight enough, bitch.
Deal with it.
Yeah. So, I end up getting my bachelor's in Vermont at Linden State College.
Was part
all
of that,
kinds of honors.
Was part
and
of
shit.
That trying to get the fuck out though? When you went to Vermont, because that's out there, man. Is that just trying to get the fuck away from Connecticut? The contacts, the links, everything that tied you in. Were you really just trying to get the fuck away?
Yeah, I think I wanted a simpler way of life. You know, that when you're doing the biker thing and the drug thing and that whole when you're in that lifestyle, it consumes you. It consumed me.
Yeah.
You end up losing who you are. You know? And it's easy to get caught up in some stuff that's going to ruin your life.
Well, don't
long range, you know, implications of just terrible shit.
And we allow it to redefine us. Like, we'll take that lifestyle and go, this is who I am. We redefine ourselves by the actions, by the environment, by what's happening.
That lifestyle is so attractive, was so attractive to me, and I know it's attractive to others because I've discussed this with some folks. You could treat it like a rock star. You could treat it better than a rock star because people aren't afraid of rock stars, okay,
damn,
for the most part.
Damn.
So you go places, it's like the Red Sea parting, you know what I mean? Guys want to be like you, women want to be with you. You get to do whatever you want. People comp your drinks, they give you drugs, they do this, they do that, you know what I mean?
That's a huge aspect I haven't talked to about anyway, that fear implication that comes with it, that persona of it.
you experienced it in that club, in that situation where everything was cool, and then all of a sudden the vibe got really nasty, and you're like, uh-oh, this shit might go down. And then, you know, the table turned and it went back. You know what I mean? But that danger is always right there under the surface. That violence. It's part of the culture. It really is.
That becomes a drug.
Oh, it's stronger than a drug.
Yeah.
You know, you get addicted to the lifestyle. Money, guns, women, cars.
The what the fuck
jewelry,
might happen.
Drugs. The excitement of the unknown.
Yeah.
I remember one time we're at a clubhouse and these guys showed up and they weren't really invited to the party. So they started dropping names. I know so-and-so and I know so-and-so. So my buddy Dirty, who was the vice president of the club at the time of this chapter, he's standing at the gate and he's got his sergeant in arms and a few other brothers here, and then he's got a bunch of us right here. Almost like a phalanx, you know what I mean?
I'm seeing a pretty good layout right here.
Right, and there's these three guys, and I remember wanting something to happen, you know, just so I could get some relief and some release.
The action is the juice.
It is, man.
Yeah.
It is a drug. Yeah. So what I found it did for me was, because listen, I'm a really decent guy.
You're trying to get into heaven. That's all.
That's all.
Yeah.
You know,
I say that
one, one kind act at a time, you know.
Yeah, like I'm trying to get into heaven. I get it.
Yeah, that's it. So I found that it changed my personality. You know, you start believing the hype.
Yeah.
I'm a badass. I'm this, I'm that, you know. I'm an enforcer. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
whatever sure. you know, whatever situation. So I think that part, especially wanting to go back to school, you know.
What part of Vermont were you in when you went up?
I was in Orleans, which is right near Newport, which is 10 miles from the Canadian border.
You know you're fucking out there if you got to go, I'm in this place that's 10 miles from this place that's closest to this place to the place you heard of.
It's called the Northeast Kingdom. They call it God's country.
Okay.
That's no shit.
Yeah. And
it's beautiful.
And how much of that was really trying to tap out? Just trying to be like, so I'm unreachable. I can't reach out. I'm just disappearing right now.
Quite a bit. That's pretty much off the grid.
Yeah.
Not now. Now, and then we're talking almost 30 years ago. You know
sure,
what I mean?
Sure.
Because now everything's global. You can't hide anymore.
Yeah, there's no off the grid.
If you think you're going to do crimes and you're going to go hide somewhere,
yeah, good luck.
Eventually John Walsh and America's Most Wanted are going to show up at your door.
Yeah, I feel like an old motherfucker when I'm like, it ain't what it used to be. You just
because it ain't.
You just can't just do what you used to, man. They know everything, man. I mean, off the grid is not. People think that because they don't have Facebook, they're off the grid, and I laugh at them. I'm like, you're right.
Yeah, okay.
Right,
your TV's listening to you.
Yeah, the fuck.
My wife and I were talking about some shit, and all of a sudden, talking about it.
Yeah,
all of a sudden, it's popping up on my phone. I go, "This ain't good."
Yeah, it's not.
No good's gonna come from this.
No, man. No.
I always say, "Well, if you're listening, Big Brother, fuck you."
Yeah.
You know that's gonna get me in some trouble.
I'm already on a list with this show. Don't worry. If you'd have heard the last podcast I did, fucking 4 hours ago, 5 hours ago, I'm already on.
I don't
list.
Have that much energy.
Oh, dude, I went off for a fucking hour. I dropped choice words. I'm on a list. I promise you that shit.
I'll guarantee you.
Yeah, well,
you better buy your books with cash, buddy.
I'm on a few lists now. I thought I got off
hey,
one, then I got
you're
out
on
of
the
one.
Shit list.
Yeah, I'm on the watch this motherfucking list right here. But
we're gonna keep an eye on them.
So you go to Vermont.
Go to Vermont. Get a job milking cows.
That's fucking funny to me, man.
And
but I don't know. I laugh because the rush and the juice of the life of living that, and then trying to go now I'm milking a fucking cow every day, man. I can't. That's
not one, hundreds,
hundreds of cows. Are right? You trying? That's trying to avoid. You know, I don't. That's like I don't know, man. That's like substitute methamphetamine for Advil. You know what I mean? Like it's not doing the same shit.
You're just not going to hit the pain the same way.
It's not, man. But I get it, though. But I get it.
Well, I also had family up there. And I used to go up there with my family, my mom and dad and my sister. We would always go up to my uncle's farm when I was a kid, and I always loved it.
Yeah.
And it was always kind of like a safe haven anyway, you know.
Now I'm connecting it. Okay.
So, and my cousin still had a dairy farm up there. So we went up there with the intention of farming and checked out places and talked to cattle brokers and all kinds of shit. And as it turned out, because I didn't have enough quote-unquote farming experience, they didn't want to give me a small business loan.
Yeah.
So we ended up buying a tenement house, five apartment house, which used to be the original hospital in the town of Orleans, the village of Orleans. I joke about that in my stand-up.
Yeah, village.
I come from a small village in Vermont. It was 800 people. There were more cows than people in the village, you know. So we did the tenement thing, and then we were there 4 years, and then I got accepted to law school in Orlando. And the minute we moved to Orlando, all the tenants stopped paying their rent. So I had a 5-year lease with option on the house. So as the end of the lease is coming up, I get a letter from the guy who owns the house and the realtor. Oh, yeah, well, we're ready for you to sign the contract to buy the house. So I just I looked at the contract. It's a lease with option. It doesn't say anything about I have to do anything. So, and the guy was a prick. You know what I mean? He and his family were border guards for multi-generations, and they were just assholes. And everybody in the town was afraid of these guys. Come on, man.
Really?
No. Come on. Really?
Yeah.
Really? You go... Just kick the shit off your shoes and sit down, son. You know what I mean? here, dip into my bag of Red Man. So, our lease was up.
So, Orlando became the choice because of the law school acceptance.
Oh, yeah, because I applied to law schools in Boston, you know, because I wanted to go to a prestigious law school.
Yeah.
But I had a low LSAT. You know what I mean? I had great GPA, but low LSAT.
Yeah.
And listen, fucking 37-year-old white dude with a low LSAT is not going to get into any school in Boston.
Yeah.
Unless you got some juice. I didn't have the juice, which turned out great, though.
Yeah, so you come down here.
Oh, on August 31st, I overnighted the key to the apartment to the owner with a letter saying, I'm not exercising my option. Fuck off.
That's my boy.
You know? Because he was being a dick.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Plus, you know, we had to pay out of pocket that year because the minute we left, all those fucking lowlife stopped paying their rent.
Yeah.
You know, my guy would go to collect the rents. They'd be hiding inside. He knows they're in there. You know, you see the curtain moving. Nobody's home.
Yeah. Lisa.
Rent, man.
At least it wasn't the other collections. You know what I mean? When you're going to what you were doing, you know?
I had a Mastiff, a 200-pound Mastiff that I rescued when we were there.
Yeah.
We went to Connecticut to get him. Usually these people would meet you halfway with the dog. We had to drive all the way to New London, Connecticut from northern Vermont because this poor bastard had been locked in a house no less than 30 days.
Oh.
His owner checked himself in the rehab, didn't tell anybody, so the dog survived on toilet water for at least 30 days.
Huh.
This dude's 80-year-old father found the dog, brought him to a Mastiff rescue. So we go down and... this dog's 100 pounds. He's supposed to be 180, right? He's 105, I think. So the lady pulls up in the Jeep, and we had the back door of our car open. This old dog, this old dude, he gets out, and he walked right in and got in the back of our car. Like, all right, here we go.
You know what would have been funny? If he gave the touchdown symbol, and then you knew.
He might have. I was just amazed. Like, oh, look at this cat, man.
He gave the touchdown symbol. Wrap it up. We're taking him home.
We're taking him home. So we stop at McDonald's on the way back, and we get him a couple of cheeseburgers, and he's got this huge fucking head and this little skinny-ass body, you know?
Yeah.
So we get him home. We get him healthy. He's 200 pounds.
Nice. And, you know, the one you still
and
got.
And he's old.
This is the one you still have.
No, man. This is in the early 1990s.
I was hoping. I'm sorry.
He's not living that old.
I'm sorry. I was hoping.
It's all good. Man. Well, I still got I got a Mastiff and a
Great
Dane.
That's what I know.
Dane.
You got a Mastiff and a Great Dane. I knew you had that.
Big man, big dogs.
Yeah, that's how it goes.
So we got the dog, and the dog used to like to sit near the door in the kitchen. And the kitchen had one of these split doors where you got you could close the top and the bottom. So we used to keep the bottom closed and open the top. And the Jehovah Witnesses were coming. So I saw him coming. I was like, no, don't do it. I'm not interested. No, we just want to talk to you, brother. I'm like, not interested. Don't do it. So they get up on the stoop, right? And the dog stands up, and his head goes over the top of the door. And all you can see is this massive fucking head, right? And he just goes, woof. And they slowly back up. I said, I warned you.
Yeah, I was that guy that always greeted the Jehovah Witness with a debate. I would say, step into my garage. And he'd step in and I'd light a blunt. And I'd light a blunt and I'd go, so tell me about it. Then they start talking. I would answer back in rapport. I did that one or two times before they're like, we're never going back there again. They just fucking kept leaving every time.
One of our tenants was on probation, and the probation office was about 25 miles away, south St. Johnsbury. They're supposed to make spot visits. These two probation officers that used to come up were 6'5 and 6'6.
Damn.
Big boys, right? They would always call me and go, hey, make sure the dog's in when we get there. So I'd tell the kid, hey, they're coming, man.
Man. Dude, so I'm going to fast forward us, yeah?
Do whatever you want, man.
You're writing two scripts right now.
Yes.
You're
not prescriptions.
Yeah, not anymore.
Kind of like screenplays.
Right, you're writing two screenplays, yes, right now, or the stories that they'll become.
Yes.
You know, you become an attorney, you know, did this story with the homeless guy happen?
No, I was in undergrad. I was getting my associates Connecticut. And I took a Problems of Urban Society class.
Yeah.
And I was always one of those guys, like an existentialist. I wanted to do things. I wanted to participate. I like to read about stuff. But, you know, if we're gonna go slide down the mountain, you know, I don't want to read about it. I want to slide down
the mountain. I want to slide down the motherfucker. You know? Yeah, there's some great existentialists up there, man.
I see that. I was really impressed when I was looking over there.
You know what I felt, though? I felt I was racist when I put that wall up. I'm like, that's a lot of old white dudes.
Back then, that's what you had.
Yeah, I mean, Carl Jung is up there, and fucking, I had to put Freud, as weird as he is, he's up there, and then Albert Ellis, you know, and Bandura. So I'm like, what the, this is not cool, man. I'm going to get judged for this shit.
It's a judgment-free zone.
Yeah.
So you're saying. I take the class, and I had a really cool professor, Tim Jacobs, and I said, hey, man, and I was also at the time doing volunteer work at a homeless shelter in Waterbury, Connecticut.
You're really trying hard to get into heaven.
I was trying to make a difference. You know, I was trying to... Listen, man, like I said, I was a champion for the underdog and the downtrodden, you know? And so I'm doing my volunteer work. So we went every holiday and every Sunday night. And when I say every holiday, Thanksgiving... we would spend half a day with the family, and at night they knew we were going to the shelter. Christmas, half the day with the family, we were going to the shelter. Easter, whatever the holiday was. 4th of July, and every Sunday night. We did that for 2.5 years. So I tell my professor, I go, hey, man, I want to do a project where I go out on the streets posing as a homeless guy. He goes, okay. You know, so we talk about what I'm going to do, and I meet one of the homeless guys, and we hit it off. And in November of 1994, I went out and lived with this guy, posing as a homeless guy, with the homeless guy, and lived out on the streets for a week without anybody knowing what was going on. It's called... it's called participant. What is it called? It's participation without intervention. I just let everything flow. I didn't interrupt.
No dropping money.
No. However it went, you know. So I did that for a week, and my wife and my mom, after the week, they were like, because I would call them from payphones and shit, because we're talking the early 90s. There's no cell phones.
Yeah.
So I would call him, you know, yeah, I'm okay. 90s,
that means 35 cents a call, not a quarter anymore.
Brother, can you spare a dime and a quarter?
Yeah, that's it, baby, yeah.
So I did it for a week. They were like, you got to come home. We're losing our fucking shit, you know. So I did that, and I made a little documentary about it called The Forgotten Many. I did some public speaking about it. I wrote a report on it for my class. And I became friends with the dude, Donnie. And he ended up dating my sister-in-law, and he was a part of our family for a year and a half. And he ended up ODing and dying. But he was in active addiction. He got clean. He got a job. He got a car. He got an apartment. He was doing great. And then he started to use drugs again, and he lost his car. He lost his apartment. He lost his job. And ultimately, he lost his life, because what happened was he had fucked over some drug dealers, and he was an intravenous drug user, and they gave him a bag of dope with battery acid in it. So it locked him up immediately. Yeah. And it's funny, because I was working in a place as a security guard, an environmental waste treatment plant, and I was doing the overnights, and in the morning, the guy would drop off the newspaper, and I opened it up, and in the obituaries, it said, Hispanic man found dead. Donnie wasn't Hispanic, but he was like, I think he might have been Greek. He had olive-colored skin, so, he, you know, he looked Hispanic. And it didn't mention any names, but I knew it was him.
You knew, right?
I knew. The second I read that, I knew it was him.
Oh, you just felt it inside, man.
Oh, I felt it inside. And this was the kicker of everything. When he lost his place to live, we let him stay with us for a few days. I didn't want him to stay at the house because I knew he was using. But my wife was like, no, no, you can't do that. So I come home from work one day, and he's scratching and nodding on the couch. The coffee maker, there's coffee all over the counter, and the tea kettle is bright red, screaming on the stove, empty. And he's scratching and nodding. So I wake him up, you motherfucker, you're on dope, get the fuck out of my house. My wife comes home shortly after. Oh, you know, hey, give him a chance, this and that, the other thing. I'm like, he needs to get the fuck out of here. Well, he ended up staying overnight, and when we came home the next day, he was gone. He had stolen my wife's heirloom engagement ring that her great-great-grandmother had passed down. Her class ring, some cash, all this other shit. I find the stuff at the pawnbroker, and this guy's an asshole, and, you know, he's just a dick, right?
Yeah.
So now I'm going to go find Donnie. Because, listen, I went out and lived on the streets with him. I know where he hangs out.
Yeah, you know the spots.
So it takes me a couple of weeks, but I finally find him. And I see him at a 7-Eleven. And he's got a couple of his buddies with him. So I park my truck up the hill, and I'm trucking down the hill. And his buddies see me, but he does not. So I roll up on him, and there's about a 4-foot chain link fence. I grab him by the nape of the neck, and I'm shaking him, and he's bending over the thing. I go, you motherfucker, we were family. We were brothers. How could you steal from me? And I'm going on and on and on. All of a sudden, I feel this burning sensation in my chest. I look over, and it's two Waterbury cops. And then I recognize one of them is my cousin's brother-in-law, Nicky. Nicky goes, hey, George, hey, Nicky. So he goes, hey, man, you can't do this out in the open. He says, do like we do. Take him in the alley, beat the shit out of him.
Yeah, yeah.
So that was the last time I saw him. And then a couple of weeks later, I read the obituary, knowing it was him. So the two screenplays are basically the 7 days I spent with him, you know, on the street. And then the other one is the time that we spent as a family unit. Listen, we did holidays together. We went little vacations together. He stayed at my house. You know what I mean? Anything that family does, we did.
Yeah, yeah.
And it wasn't until a few years ago I realized what a resentment I had against him, because I felt he had abandoned me. See, I got abandonment issues since this whole thing started. You know,
touchdown
what I mean?
Is all I'm saying. Hey! Touchdown is all I'm saying.
Hope we get that extra point.
Yeah, yeah. Go back to the early podcast. You know what it means. But yeah, I get that.
Keep listening, folks. So, I told a gentleman I know all about it, and this gentleman recently sold a screenplay for six figures. to some folks in Hollywood.
Yeah.
And they were negotiating with Bruno Mars to play the lead in that, which was very cool. But what he did was he sent me his screenplay to show me exactly the format.
Yeah.
So I would know how to do it. Yeah. And it's funny because I've mentioned this to a few people, and it's amazing how supportive a lot of people are. And they want to help any way they can, which is super cool. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I've got stuff written, and I let the guy listen to it, the guy from out in California, and his name is Dave, and he loved it. You know what I mean? He goes, "There's nothing like this out there."
Yeah.
He said, "This shit is going to be fly." Yeah. You know?
I think it's good too, man. Yeah.
I didn't bring it, but I'll share it with you. And what I did was, it's just a natural progression of people talking to each other and getting to know each other.
That's what this podcast is all about, baby. Sitting across from, like, and feeling you, man.
Yeah.
Like, I've known you for years, or less than maybe, but I see you. You know what I mean? When we're talking, I connect with you. So that's what it's about, though.
For me, there are people in my life where when I meet them, it feels like I've known them my whole life.
That's how I felt, man, when I first met you.
Well, you know how Adam reached out to me to do a comedy show, and he was going to be on the show. And so I drive all the way up to New Smyrna Beach from Orlando area, and this fucking guy blows off the show because he's got a show that's paying better.
Yeah, no, so I don't know where I was.
No, that's what Patricia said. You had a better paying gig, which was
I don't
fine.
Know where I was, but I know I was so nervous that night. You know why I was so nervous?
No, please tell me.
I was so nervous because I knew she'd host, she'd be fine.
Yeah.
But a choice biker organization had decided to start making this location their fucking Friday night hangout.
Yeah, and they were there that night.
And so I didn't know you from sideways. I got a recommendation. I looked you up, saw a thing, and I was like, I like this guy. You know, and so you book, and I'm like, fuck, I can't go. I don't even know where I was. And then I hear you kill. I hear you, like, you saved the show is what I heard, really.
We had a lot of fun.
I heard you saved the show.
It was great because I was probably a little, at least this distance away, maybe a little closer to the table right in front. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And they were having some fun, so I was able to have fun with them. It turned out to be a really good show. I enjoyed myself. And the food, this was the Off the Hook in New Smyrna.
Yeah, Off the Hook.
The food was delicious. My wife and I ate beforehand, you know what I mean? So I had a full belly, and, you know, I was ready to rock. So
I remember trying to find you. I had found some other person that wasn't you that was pulling up.
Someone who masquerading as me?
Yeah. And so I kept on. I'm like, that's not the same guy. So I looked at the pictures. I'm like, it's not the same guy. It took me fucking an hour or two to figure out what picture to actually use in the flyer, trying to figure that shit out. But, man, when you went up there, man, Patricia called me, and she's like, he fucking was great. He was really good.
Yeah, she was super cool. And as we're talking outside the venue afterwards, she tells me that she does stand-up. I go, that's fucked up. I said, you should have done some time tonight. She goes, well, maybe another time.
She still says that today. She still goes,
yeah, but she was doing some stuff with the monkey, so that was cool.
Yeah, she's still doing that today, man. But that was a while ago. That inner. So I'm gonna jump to a deep place.
Uh-oh.
With you, man.
Deeper, you mean?
Yeah, deeper, baby.
I usually don't share this kind of material. So you know.
I know you don't, man. I know you don't, man. I appreciate you doing it, man.
Only because I love you.
Yeah, and you love a lot of people. Look, man, I haven't met one person in the comedy scene or anywhere else that knows you that has ever said anything ill about you. If anything, they boast about who you are. And to be honest, they said something bad in front of me, I'm going to fuck them up. I'm going to be honest. You know, and then I'm going to call my attorney.
Everybody's entitled to their opinion.
But then I'm going
to
call my attorney after that. But no, man, I'm going to jump right in.
Yeah.
You died once.
More than once.
Yeah.
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 You talking about the most recent one?
Yeah, man.
Yeah, I OD'd in 2011, and
that hurts my heart to even hear, man.
It sounds strange to hear me saying it. You know what I mean?
I mean, I had patients that came through when I was a counselor, man, that I would see, and 6 months later I wouldn't see again, or I would see for 2 or 3 years. That they come through, and I do my best to help the best I could. And I lost a lot of patients, you know, along the way, man. But and friends, lost a few.
That's
friends.
The difficult part of the job.
Fuck, man.
You know, because I'm a counselor at law. okay? I don't consider myself an attorney at law. I'm a counselor because I counsel people.
Yeah.
You know, and nothing more difficult than advising and counseling and guiding someone through the legal process only for them to turn around and do exactly the opposite of what you suggested and what you talked to them about, and then see them get sentenced to long stretches of prison or wind up in jail or even take or keep committing the same kind of crimes and mistakes. You know what I mean? That for me is difficult. But, you know, my wife Sue, she is the best. And, you know, as a criminal defense attorney, I always hate to see people go to jail or prison. But my wife, in her infinite wisdom, you know, she always brings me back. She gives me a reality check, brings me back to her.
Yes, is that
she goes, some people need to go free, some people need probation, some people need jail, some people need prison, and some people need to die. Whew. And that, you talk about heavy, you want to get heavy?
Damn, Susan.
We could segue into some really heavy shit from
Damn,
there.
Damn, Susan.
You know, she keeps it real, bro. You know what I mean?
Yeah, shout out to you.
So, it is what it is, you know. You want them to know more about that, I imagine?
No, I...
Okay, just, well,
it's
okay.
Up to you,
well,
baby.
This is what happened. I OD. I'm in the bed. We had a rescue, Red Nose Pit, that we rescued, who wakes Sue up because I'm convulsing in the bed. Sue gets up. You know, she's a nurse for 30 years. She checks my vitals, my blood pressure, my sugar. She calls 911. They come to the house. I stopped breathing on the way to the hospital there. And they couldn't intubate me because I had this really thick neck, and my vocal cords, instead of being in the back, were more centralized, so they had a really tough time to intubate me. And in the process, they chipped all of my front teeth. And I never got them fixed because I wanted that reminder. Every time my tongue ran over those teeth, I could feel those cracks and chips to remind me of that last time that I used drugs, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
So they get me to the hospital. Now I'm in a vegetative state. It takes 10 people to tie me down to the bed. I'm tied like an animal, spread eagle. I got wires, hoses. If I got a hole, there's a wire or a plug in it. I'm on a ventilator. My wife sends me to the hospital where she used to work. She handpicks the doctors and the nurses. She says, George is coming in. So the neuro guy tells my wife after, I don't know, like a day, get his affairs in order. Call his family because he's either going to remain vegetative or he's going to die.
Checking you out already.
The cardiologist and the internist, both say this is metabolic, Sue. He's going to be okay. So my pastor cousin, I call him number one, Joe, he does a worldwide prayer vigil over me. 1.5 million people throughout this planet are praying for me while I'm in this coma. 3 days later, I come out of the coma with no physical or neurological problems that I didn't have before I went in.
After that amount of time, there's no way.
I'm telling you, man.
Yeah.
That's my higher power at work. And it was at that point in my life where my whole perspective changed. You know, it wasn't about me anymore. It was about helping other people. What can I do to help somebody else? You know, I started to question my choice of career as a lawyer. So my mentor and a bunch of my lawyer friends and some other friends and family collectively and individually basically said, what are you out of your fucking mind? You know what I mean? You work this hard. You're really good at what you do. You are helping people. Because now I have self-doubt. I'm doubting whether or not I'm doing the right thing. And for me, if I have a life-changing experience like this, near death, and if it doesn't change me for the better, then I'm pretty fucked up. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I decided I was going to stay in the profession, and I started getting even better results with what I was doing. And my clean date is 4/20, 2011.
Of course it is. Of course it is.
Of course it is, man. I've been clean since then. Every day of my life is a combination of Christmas, Hanukkah, Kwanzaa, and Festivus for the rest of us. I live life beyond my wildest expectations. I live a charmed, blessed life. You know, I talk about this every day.
You do?
Yeah.
I know you do.
I go, look at this life. We were doing it on Sunday.
Yeah, yeah.
I said we were having brunch on Sunday down at the La Boheme, and I just said, look at this life we lead, man. You know? Yeah. If I can't give praise to my higher power for this life, then I'm doing it wrong.
Yeah.
You know, and if I can't give back, when I get out of myself and help somebody else, that's when I know my life is really progressing in the right direction.
Is that what pushed you into comedy?
Actually, no. I've been writing for a long time. I'd done theater. I had a rock band, public speaking. You know, as an attorney, a litigator, you know, all the world's my stage, okay? Yeah. I have a friend, my mentor, my comedy mentor, Ron Feingold, and we were at his house, I don't know, some years ago on Thanksgiving. And I've been writing material for a long time. So his wife said to me, she goes, you know, honey, you're really funny. Why don't you stop being a pussy and go on stage?
Is this Susan again?
No, this is Laura.
Oh, Laura, okay.
Ron's wife.
Laura. Ron's wife, okay, yeah. Ron Feingold.
Like, damn, man, she dropped the gauntlet at my wife, you know? And Laura's like 98 pounds soaking wet. Anyway, damn, that's cold. So on my birthday some years ago, Ron lets me do a little spot, guest spot at Gregory's on the beach in Cocoa, and I bombed. I did what they call, folks, I ate a bag of dicks.
Yeah.
Which means I was horrific. So Eugene Torres was the host. He was supportive.
Oh, no shit.
So,
yeah,
Eugene's
yeah.
great, man. He was supportive, and, you know, and Ron, of course, was cool. And one of my close friends, Big Mike, was there, and he was cheering me on. And there was a heckler that I was fucking with.
It's a shit show.
Yeah, it was beautiful. So after that, now I'm like, ah, oh, this shit's not for me, man, you know. So some time passes, and I got all this material. I'm like, fuck it, you know. Ron's like, just go do some open mics, man. What the hell's wrong with you? So I go to the Drunken Monkey in Orlando, and, you know, it's a different, listen, I'm in my 50s. These kids are in their 20s, teens, 20s, maybe 30s. You know, I don't party. They party. So, you know, not only do we have a generational thing, we have a cultural thing. We have an entertainment, whatever. There's differences that don't seem to be able to be reconciled very easily. So I go there and nobody fucking talks to me. Nobody looks at me. I go up there and I do my shit, and one time there was all these high school kids there, and they're sitting there, and about halfway through I go, you know what, fuck you, you're going to suffer. I'm going to power through this for the next 2.5 minutes, and you motherfuckers are going to suffer as much as I am. Now I'm getting laughs. So one night David Jolly is there.
Yeah.
And he throws his arm around me. He goes, hey, man, we're going over to Bull and Bush after this. Why don't you come get some more time? And my wife was in the hospital at the time. And I said, I love to, man, but Mama's in the hospital. I got to go back to the hospital. You go, oh, you take care of Mama. Take care of Mama. And David and I have been tight ever since. And he's one of my favorite people in comedy. He's one of my favorite people. David Jolly is one of the funniest motherfuckers on the planet.
Yeah. Agreed.
He is a shining star, and someday, if you folks, I'm going to tell you right now, write this name down, David Jolly. He's going to be huge. He is very, he's just a funny guy. I look at him, I smile. You
dude,
know what
he,
I mean?
He opened up the comedy club, you know, December 6th.
Yeah.
Our opening show. He was the headliner.
Yeah. He's fucking great, man. So I started doing some stand up, you know, some open mics. Ron Feingold says to me, I think it was February of 2018, I want you to host up in Claremont at the Black Box Theater. I'm going to headline. I want you to host. Get 10 minutes of material. 10 good minutes. At this point, I got like five, a tight five, they call it. You know what I mean? Yeah. So I said, okay, fine. So Ken Miller down at the other bar lets us go down on a Monday night where they do the open mic. So I got on there, and I'm trying out some other material. The only people in the place are comics. And let me tell you, folks, comics are the worst spectators.
This is the worst fucking audience.
They're all on
time.
Their fucking phones. They're all talking. They couldn't give two shits about what you're doing. So I can't gauge how my material's hitting, but what I'm doing is get my timing right. So I go up to Claremont, and I do really well. It's a great show. It's almost sold out. I got a bunch of friends and family there. I'm telling jokes about my family because most of my shit's true life stuff, and a lot of it's family-oriented. So I got family members in the audience. I'm telling jokes about them, and they're digging it.
So yeah, you trousers? Why do you need trousers? I love that fucking joke.
Yeah, I joke about my dad's dementia. I'm trying to get into heaven, but I'm probably going to meet Adam in hell. You know what I'm saying? Hold the door for me, buddy.
I got you, baby. I got you.
So I started doing a lot of open mics, and now I'm getting put on showcases with people. You know, that's the beautiful thing. People who run shows are super giving, and a lot of them are nurturing, and you know, as you're coming around and coming up, you know, they give you a chance to go out there and, you know, hone your craft and really, you know, have some great fun. So they have a contest at the other bar, New Faces.
Yeah, what's going on right now?
They got a show tomorrow night, folks, at the Improv in Orlando. Get your tickets and get free tickets.
Yeah.
They got some great comics. Ken Miller's going to be there. Kerman Gonzalez is going to be there. A few other people. Maybe Carmen might be performing. I'm not sure.
Yeah.
But go out and have a great time and support local comedy. These people are very funny.
Yeah, all the new faces, man.
All the new faces.
I saw some of those winners through those rounds, and I was like, oh, shit.
I know. They got it going on, bro.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So they do the new faces thing, and it comes out that I end up doing second in the audience vote and top five in the judges vote. But only the first couple of them get to go to the Improv, which is fine. So they have an audition. A little while later, they have an audition for Bonkers hosts and guest spots. So I was at a function. So this is supposed to start at 9 o'clock. At 8:45, they round up all the comics and say, no F-bombs, G-rated. Okay. Well, I get there at 9:30, but this is what I'm told. No F-bombs. Well, okay. So I got to adjust my material a little, but I can still do it. So Ken Miller introduces me. Yeah, yeah, please welcome a new young face of comedy, Big Biker George. And what Ken told me after the fact is that when he first met me, he was like, look at this motherfucker, you know? Oh, and he's got the name and everything. But then, you know, he says, oh, yeah, he's pretty funny, you know?
Yeah.
So he introduces me, and this is my first joke. I said, isn't Ken Miller a great-looking brother? I said, he's so fine, I let him bang my daughter without a condom.
Oh.
And then I go, no, that's not true. I'd put the condom on him myself. Then I do my set, and people are laughing, and they're losing it. They have a great time. The judges are laughing. I'm watching. And then I end with two masturbatory jokes. So I go to the judges after, and they're doing their little post-show interview. And James John says, listen, man, you're really funny, but you're not bonkers material. So they don't offer me a guest spot or anything. So Jeff Jones is doing a show at the Improv, and Ken says to me, hey, man, you want to go on Jeff's show? I was like, fuck yeah, man.
Yeah, Jeff's doing a recent show. He's yeah, coming up. Yep, yeah,
yeah, Jeff's a great guy. Very yeah. funny.
We booked him into some running, too.
Yep. He's awesome. So I said to Jeff, do you have any problem with my material? He goes, you say whatever the fuck you want. So I did the Orlando Improv main stage three times in the next month and a half. And I like to consider that my big break in comedy, Bonkers Not Want Me.
Yeah.
So I've done the Improv now probably half a dozen or eight times now.
Yeah.
Yeah, and every time I go, it's just, you know, it's a great place, and, you know, the crowd is there to laugh, you know, so it's a lot of fun.
Yeah, there was a great club in Sanford that had a two-month spot.
Oh, that was a dynamite place, man. That was.
But, man, dude, I can't thank you enough for sitting down here tonight.
We're done already? I'm just playing.
It has been 2 hours.
No way.
Yeah.
Cool.
2 hours live, baby.
Excellent.
And change. But
okay, we got four comments.
Yeah,
oh, same person.
I mean, the rest of them. Yeah, but man, George, to sit down with me tonight, man, and share what you did, thank you.
You're welcome. It's my pleasure. It's my honor and privilege, bro.
Nah, it's mine, baby.
Quit it.
No, man. You
get a room, you two.
For real, man. You sit down and look, the nights I was hosting it at the Mellow Monkey and getting up there, and I introduced you every time. Where the nights I wasn't hosting, I was introing to bring you up to stage. I host, and I said it every time, man. I said, probably the nicest guy I've ever fucking met, and a guy I love very much.
Thank God you didn't meet me in the 80s.
Man. So
I might have to take you out, bro.
I was four, so I went... I was four. It wouldn't matter. But man, and we connected, man. You know that first time we met, man, and it had been close ever since, man. You and
hey, Smyrna. You never paid me for the new Smyrna gig, you prick.
Really?
Never paid me.
Really?
You know I rarely, if ever, take any money for comedy.
Wait, really?
I didn't get paid,
Patricia.
I didn't even get my meal comped.
Really?
I had at least $25 of food, man.
What the fuck?
I had steamers and
clams. Really?
On the half.
Why are you saying that shit now when I'm live? What the fuck? You're going
to
handle that?
You wanted to keep it real, right?
Yeah, I didn't know.
Oh, it's all good.
I got you right now. We got this fucking air. Got you right fucking now.
Nope.
I got you right. But no,
I'd rather have steak.
But I'd love you from day one for meeting you, man. And thanks for coming on and bearing your soul and sharing your story. And for me, I wanted to have you on to share those things, man, so people out there can hear it and find inspiration from it. And just your story is intriguing, man. And the person you are now today, I wish everybody was like you today, man.
Thanks, man. I really appreciate that.
I love you. I love you very much.
Bottom of
man.
My heart, bro. I love you.
And one of the funniest fuckers I know, too, man. I swear to God.
Hey, I'm no David Jolly.
Shout out David Jolly. But, man, thanks, man. I love you, dog.
Love you, too.